Miss Pierce, Reel 11. You were just telling me about the officer who'd been wounded. What condition was he in?
He was in a very serious condition indeed, stomach wounds, and he was taken to the theatre, and Colonel Frusho spent hours operating on him to try and save his life, but he died. And it was such an unnecessary death, because a lot of work had been put into saving his life, and he was really recovering and ready to go back to base for a full convalescence. And in just a few minutes, his life was at stake, and his life was terminated by a very careless thing. So I called an orderly when I discovered what had happened. I called an orderly and asked him to please carefully uncock that pistol and remove it downstairs. And we ordered a much tighter search on things that were brought in. The Free French were beginning to get a little bit careless, you know, and they realized after that they must be more careful, because no one was come up with any arms to the wards. We were very, very busy and had some very, very serious wounded who came from various different parts.
Did you keep the Free French and Vichy wounded apart? Separate from each other, I mean?
We had very few in Damascus. If I remember rightly, we had very few, if any, Vichy wounded. I believe the British took them on as prisoners, and they were treated elsewhere. I have very little recollection of us having Vichy prisoners at the Damascus hospital. We may have had some. I don't know if I've mentioned it in my typescript, but I don't think I have. I don't think we had many there as we did at Daraa. I think that the powers that be captured them, and they were dealt with elsewhere, probably at base. We were very, very busy, as I think I said there, but the time was coming. Of course, we did have our recreation. The front hall of the hospital was often crowded with British officers wanting to take these only British girls that were in the neighbourhood, you know, because the QAs, unfortunately, were still on the 1913 handbook.
So they couldn't get anywhere near the
fighting.
They couldn't
get anywhere near the front, because they had to have proper laundry facilities for stiff collars and belts and cuffs and caps and aprons and all the rest of it. Whereas we had taken to pale blue Tobrolco, which was a material that was in force in those days. And we just rinsed our things out and put them on unironed, providing they were clean. If we could get an iron, we got one. But I palled up, I remember. It sounds very childish when you look back on it nowadays, with a young officer who just got married. And we got friendly, and we wrote to his wife and told her so. We were a very honest couple. And she was very pleased to find that he'd found such a nice nurse. You see, he was just married, and I'd just lost someone I loved very much. So we really only wanted friendship and to go out and dance and have dinner and go and see places. And I think, if I remember rightly, he was in the Army, British Army Catering Corps. And so he had made friends with some local sheikhs to get supplies through from the Arabs, you see, food and things like that, on top of Nafi provisions. And he introduced me to some very interesting people, really, which I wouldn't have met the local people as I did unless I'd known Blackie.
I think that's very generous of his wife to believe him.
I think so, too. I've often thought back on it and thought what utter faith she had in Blackie, because there was nothing to it. And we met again in Beirut, and we used to go out sometimes, and then of course he disappeared with the British forces and I wouldn't know what happened to him. But everybody palled up with somebody in those days, and there probably were some goings on among some of them, but I don't think among many. I really don't. I think that we were too busy, and we just went out to have a good meal and a dance somewhere, which was very difficult to find, because in Damascus the Arabs didn't know what to make of us yet. They didn't know who were their friends and who were their foes. And we'd go to the wonderful bazaars and we'd buy the most beautiful brocades for a song, because they just didn't know how to treat us or what to charge us. And the place was absolutely riddled with sandfly. And you can't see the little devils, but they give you, when they've bitten you, they give you a 3-day fever, which causes depression. And I think most of us at some stage or other got sandfly fever. So we discovered that the best way to treat it was to pickle it with whiskey. But it did leave you very depressed for quite a while afterwards, but the whiskey helped. Whiskey cost us practically nothing, of course. In those days we got it through the Nafi.
Did the wounded men also get sandfly fever?
Yes, because Damascus, but we got it even more, because we went out and we went on the river, on the water, you know, to little hotels which had only dealt with the colonials, Vichy colonials, and then we went there and they were very pleased to have more custom. And being so near the water, the hospital was not so near the water, so the wounded didn't risk it quite so much as we did going out and going to these various places in Damascus. Anyway, that's another story. It's all over and done with, and we got our 3-day fever, most of us, and carried on. But it did leave you very depressed. And whiskey was a wonderful thing.
Once you'd had it, were you immune, or could you just get it again and again?
I rather think that you were immune, because I can't remember any of us getting it again. But they were not. The fly was described to us as a little red thing, almost invisible. It was so small. And there were swarms of them, because when we went on the water to a certain hotel for meals in the evening, in the lamplight, you could just about see a hazy cloud, sand-like cloud. And they told us that these were sandflies. It looked like dust, you know, a little cloud of dust. And the little devils were biting us, I presume. Well, came the day when we really had to go on to Beirut.
Why was that?
Well, we were essentially what we called ourselves a frontline unit, and we were gradually becoming less so as we remained in Damascus, because the British arrived and the fighting was moving on beyond us, you see. And the Australians, to them, anything French was a frog. It didn't matter whether it was a Vichy or a Free French. And the Australians had been fighting all French. And in Beirut, we heard that they had been moved to camps outside the town so that we would be anyhow more able to find our own Free French. Now, at about that time, in Beirut, the Vichy had been given, I can't remember how many weeks it was, whether it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks or what it was, to make up their mind whether they wanted to join the Free French. If not, they would be shipped back to France. A lot of them didn't want that, because they were colonials who had never been to France, some of them, as happened in colonies with us, you know, people born out there. And I think that they joined the Free French partly because they just didn't want to go back to France. But most of them went back and treated, until they went back, treated the Free French as their enemies. I was on night duty with Franka, the Polish nurse. So we had to go on more or less with the convoy that went ahead. And we went, I can't tell you through what beautiful country. It was described as miniature Grand Canyon. Some of it was so absolutely lovely. Through woods, then up onto the top of the mountains, and you looked down onto this bay that was Beirut, on the edge of the Mediterranean. It was a most wonderful sight, and I think you know my theme by now, and I just couldn't help, again, saying to myself, why is it that there must be wars and that we're led to such beautiful places, such beautiful sights, you know, and that there had to be war, there had to be such terrible things as war when there was so much beauty about. It seemed to me beyond understanding. But there we were, led through beauty back to war. And we were to take over part of the French military hospital, which was still in Vichy hands, because the British and the Free French were still going on this principle of letting them stay that long to try and win them over, you see. But they were to give us part of the hospital, but what we didn't know at the time was that they gave us the part that they themselves had condemned. And when we arrived there, we nurses among us that arrived first chose our rooms in a building. And I remember opening the cupboard in my room. And never before or since have I seen such enormous black beetles as were in that cupboard, nor such smelly ones. It was quite filthy, the place. And how anyone could leave a hospital of any kind in that state was beyond our understanding, but it was absolutely filthy. And then we found that the place was not only riddled with black beetles, but bed bugs in quantities that, having nursed in the East End in the days when there were such things down there, I had never seen anything like it. And Franca went to bed, and T.W., one of the drivers that had brought us, went to bed in their own rooms that they'd chosen, put the light out, and I think it was Pippa, I can't remember now, one of the nurses and myself, had gone to bed with our lights on, because we had always heard that they don't like lights. But we even found a few in our beds. But that time Franca came bursting into my room, and she was absolutely covered with bed bugs. Her eyes were all shut. They were on her eyes, they were on her face, they were on her everywhere. She was absolutely being eaten alive with these creatures. And we called down to one of the surgeons that was passing down below what we thought of them about, you know, giving us these quarters. And I'm afraid they hurled some very insulting remarks back at us and called us odious women. Whereupon we got all frightfully dignified and informed them that we would not be called such names, and we would remind them that we were British women and that we had come voluntarily from England to look after their men, and consequently we would not submit to such language or such treatment. They only laughed at us. And We spent the rest of the night. I remember there was balcony all round, and I remember putting three hard chairs on my bit of balcony, and I think the others did the same, having washed ourselves down and flitted the place in vain. We always carried flit about with us, and we flitted everything that we could, because it was before the days of aerosol and magic killers and things. And we just slept on the balcony on hard chairs. And the next day, we were shown the building in which were housed our free French wounded, which the Vichy had collected up before we came as prisoners and had put into this building, which was a condemned building. It was in a frightful state. It was infested with rats, with colonies of ants and bed bugs. I mean, you just trod on them. They were everywhere. And great, enormous, smelly black beetles. The only thing that was nice among the infestation were the little mice. I shall always remember them to this day. They were quite different to any mice I've ever seen, and I'd love to know what their name is. They were reddish-coloured fur, and they had fairly big pricked ears and long snouts and deep black eyes, and they were rather sweet. We made friends with them, but we'd heard of a case of bubonic plague at Haifa, so treated the rats with very great respect and kept to a distance. But what was terrible, we had so many of our wounded who hadn't yet been able to have proper operations, because we had no theatre there yet. And they had to sit on the window ledges, on benches, on hard chairs, because they literally couldn't occupy the beds. They were being eaten with bugs. And we waited until the Vichy went by in the dusk, and we would throw infested mattresses down onto them. We even got as far as throwing filthy lockers down onto them. And of course they hurled up abuse at us. And then they shut up when they found that one of these English nurses could hurl back abuse in their own language without an English accent. And she jolly well did. And that was me. I couldn't help it. You know, we were almost at the end of our tether. To start with, what could we do with these men? How could we look after them? All the rest of the convoy hadn't yet arrived with our equipment. We obviously couldn't stay there. We couldn't care for them under such conditions. And we had, I think it was a captain, certainly an officer, who was very badly wounded, and he had a head wound which had caused him to be completely paralyzed. He could only move his eyes. And we had a Quaker, on that first two or three nights, there was a Quaker orderly whom we called Ham, young man, and myself on. And I think Ham was very bewildered about with all this, as I was. And he came rushing up to me with a hurricane lamp, because they'd cut off the electricity, these nice Vichy, and left us to deal with hurricane lamps, to do our work with hurricane lamps. He said that this officer was bleeding to death, that he could see all the blood all over his face, and got another hurricane lamp and leant over him and found that he wasn't bleeding to death. He was literally being eaten alive by bedbugs, which he couldn't move off. So I sent Ham to the linen room to get clean linen, and I went myself and got a bowl of, you know, hot water and soap, and we were going to clean him up and put him on a clean stretcher. And he was very big and very heavy, and we weren't quite sure how we were going to get him off the one stretcher onto another. And I heard a cry from the linen room. Poor Ham had found the clean linen, and as he opened it out, in the folds of the linen were bugs. And he opened the linen room window and shook all the clean sheets out onto the Vichy down below, and the blankets as well, so we managed to have clean blankets and clean sheets, clean pillowcases for this man. We cleaned him up and somehow got him onto a stretcher in the clean things, and then kept a firm eye that bugs didn't come to him again. We flitted all round as far as much as we could. It was quite ghastly. And then gradually the convoy came and Mrs.
How did the Vichy nurses keep the bugs out of their part of the building?
I don't think they did, but it was a newer part of the building. We were in the oldest part, apparently. The original part when the colonials first went out there, you know. And I don't think they'd used that part themselves for a long time. But for all that, it wasn't kept as clean as it should be. And sometime later we discovered that all the time we were there, there were three airmen, British airmen, there in the main building being nursed. But they had got friendly with the French nurses, and they were quite happy there, and they didn't bother to find out what was happening. We were looked after by the French nurses, but we'll come back to that later. Anyway, Mrs. Spears and the rest of the convoy arrived, and she did some reconnoitering with Colonel Fruchot, and they found a hospital run by German nuns, and it was the same nuns who ran a very wonderful hospice in Jerusalem. We'd met them in Jerusalem, and of course they were made prisoners by the Free French because they were German. The British, I think, would have left them to help us nurse, but Free French turfed them out. And they did rather a cruel thing, because they sent them to, they had a house in the mountains somewhere, and they'd sent them out there knowing perfectly well that the battle had raged back and forth over the village where their house was, and that it was practically non-existent. It was a ruin. And in the cold they were camping out up there, but the British found them in the end and asked them if they would rather be interned by the Free French or the British, and they immediately said, oh please, the British. So they were packed off to Jerusalem, and already a very crowded convent of theirs they were packed into, and ran the hospice for the British officers, went through there during the war with just a guard on the gate, because they didn't want to escape anyway. But anyway, we took over this hospital, and it was absolutely spotless. No bugs, no rats, no mice, no nothing. It was really beautifully kept, and it had a hospice for guests, and we took that over as our mess. And I had a room to myself with running water. I remember saying, oh, I'm going to sleep all day today. It was all so wonderful. And our wounded were sent back to base, and we only had 20 patients, so I imagined and that we would have a very nice easy night for a change. But I got on duty to find that I was on duty with one orderly, and by the end of the night we had 60 patients, and we continued after that to be full. And we had very few British at that time, because the British had taken over another part, you know, for their wounded. And the QAs, I don't know whether they arrived into Beirut as soon as we did. I don't think so, but very soon they were able to establish. Oh, I believe two QAs came and visited us in Damascus, but had to go back to base because there were no laundry facilities for all these things that they wore, you know, and they were envying us very much, but they were still under this 1913 handbook at that time. But I don't seem to remember very many British wounded in the German hospital. And we discovered in the hospice that there was one room downstairs which was kept locked. And we thought we heard voices in there. So, of course, we went and informed Colonel Fruchot, who got someone to come round and investigate. And there were two poor German nuns in there who were terrified of us. apparently one of them was receiving treatment from a dentist or something like that, I can't remember. And the Reverend Mother had said, try and stay behind to continue your treatment and just take that one room downstairs, and left them some food. And they tried to keep hidden from us because they were afraid of us, you see. They didn't know what we would do to them because the Free French had already turfed all the others out. So we craftily informed the British. Colonel Fuchsia was a bit annoyed with us. We informed the British that these two nuns were there, and the British took care of them, took them off our hands. And they probably saw that they got the treatment that they needed. But they were terrified of the Free French, because, you see, they were Vichy, so-called, because they'd been there in the Vichy days. But how Germans could be Vichy, we weren't quite sure. But the Free French treated them all as the same thing. You see, they were their enemies, whether they were German or Vichy. And we were frightfully busy, not only with wounded, but with pneumonia cases and fever cases and all sorts of things. And he and Nancy operated by night, as they had always done. We had a most beautiful theatre there with every bit of equipment and supplies. The nuns had left most wonderful supplies behind and left us the keys of their storerooms and everything. They'd locked the chapel, hoping that that would stay intact. But what they did, they turned it into a military chapel, so that was all right. Because we had a chaplain attached to the unit, a Catholic chaplain, an Irishman, because of them being chiefly so-called Catholics, you see, the Free French. So they had their chaplain. He was an Englishman, or an Irishman. So he saw to the church and all the church linen, saw that nothing happened to it, none of it was stolen. But at night, we were very, very busy with our wounded, and we had, if I remember rightly, we had a captain on one of the floors above who persistently rang his bell about every 10 minutes whilst we were dealing with very bad cases. We had, I remember, one case of multiple wounds, wounded from head to foot in various places, and he was an epileptic. And on top of his wounds, he had epileptic fits every 5 to 10 minutes. Of course, he didn't last the night. It was too much for him. And I went and asked for another orderly because of this wretched man who kept ringing his bell. He didn't really need to, but he was one of those, you know, who wanted attention every so often, wanted someone to do something for him, which he could well have done for himself. And we had our wounded coming in batches, and we kept them longer because we weren't really at the front anymore. The fighting had sort of remained back and round the outskirts of Beirut. So we kept our wounded far longer before we sent them to base. And we stayed there over Christmas, and time was coming when we must move on. And the Free French were ordered to go into the Western Desert whilst we were in Beirut. We had an extraordinary Christmas before we left. Rather a lonely one in some ways. We met up with various English officers and went out to dinner and had far too much to drink. And I remember on our way back, a group of us, we saw a large building, and I had had a few drinks too many, I presume. And two of us were found climbing up the outside fire escape stairs of this building. And two English officers came out of a door on the stairs on the way down. They said, hey, this is no place for you. And they sort of escorted us down. It seemed it was a red light place. And we were entering it freely, not knowing what we were doing. It was Christmas Eve, and we were far from home, and we'd all had a good drink. You know what I mean? And It must have been on one of my nights off, I presume. My mind's gone a bit blank. You'll have to help me for... So once more, we packed up all our convoy, which was... We were told when it was spread out in proper formation, all the trucks and the staff cars and the autoclave, mobile theatre, mobile mattress fumigation plants. We were very up to date because we'd bought the equipment in America. And we were told that our convoy was about 5 miles long when it...